The New South Wales vehicular ferries played a crucial role in the road transport network. This is particularly the case with the North Coast ferries, where, for example, the Clarence River ferries provided a means of crossing the river on the main north-south highway right up until the late 60s. Terry Doolan, bridge maintenance planner at RTA Grafton office, describes the geography of the Clarence River Delta.
The Clarence River's the biggest river on the eastern seaboard of Australia. At Grafton, I was saying before, it's 800 metres wide. It's a massive river. There are 99 islands in the Clarence River up until 10 years ago, and now there are 100. Probably 20 or 30 have cane growing on them or vegetables growing on them, and the only way to get the produce to land was to do it by some form of boat or ferries. So there are a lot of farmers who run ferries to their islands privately in the Clarence River. Wherever there are bridges on the island or on the river, there used to be ferries. And a lot of the islands are populated. A lot of them have towns on them. And there would have been ferries to all those islands. But there are umpteen ferries on the Clarence. There are probably 30 or 40 ferries operating around the turn of the century. And some council, some private, and some state-owned.
The cane industry has had a long history on all the North Coast rivers. Cane, grown on the farms, was transported to refineries in the area on cane barges right up until the late 70s. Ray Wedgwood explains the changes in the cane industry and the impact on the North Coast ferries.
Sugar cane used to be brought down from the where the cane was grown by little railway lines, little railway tracks, and they used to cut across the highway and down to the river, either the Clarence or the Richmond or the Tweed, and then it would go on barges down the river to the sugar mill. And I don't know when it was, through the 60s, I guess, early 70s, the mode of transport changed, and instead of transporting the cane by the little trains and the barges, that started to be transported by semi-trailers. And you'd see they'd have spots by the side of the road where the cane would be in big containers, which open containers, which would be put on the semis and carted. And one of the things that I got involved with then professionally early in my career was the Bluff Point ferry. The flaps on the end of the ferry where it rides it up onto the road broke, and it turned out that it was the cane trucks transporting the cane at low tide, because of the change in grade as it came down onto the ferry and over the flap, the triaxle at the back taking the load, which would legally have about 20 tonnes on it and probably illegally was more highly loaded, two of the axles lifted off, so all the load went through one axle onto this flap and the flap broke. So we had to redesign the flaps for this ferry. And it was what we ended up with was a bit like the front end of a battleship, but they never broke again.
There are also many vehicular ferries on the Richmond River. Mari Newman, local historian and author, recounts the history of the river and the steam-powered vehicle ferries.
William Yabsley came to Corakai in 1849. And he built up a big shipping business. Strangely enough, a young American built up a very successful shipping business on the other side of the river. His name was Jaeger. You know, they were trying to get a ferry service, government funded or part locally funded service, but there's no exact record of when that began operating. But in William Yabsley's diaries, you can see that such a service started operating probably in the 1870s, because he built and launched a ferry in August 1879. Those little early ferries seemed to be hand-operated ferries, and it wasn't until September 1910 that they a steam ferry built in Ballina went into operation.
Steam ferries were the precursor to diesel ferries on most New South Wales crossings. Edith Dobbin and Margaret Schweitzer, Clarence River residents, recall the old steam ferry at Harwood.
The workroom, or the, what would you call it, the
engine room.
Or the cabin.
The cabin.
All the brass clocks and all the time clocks were brass and they were polished to the nth degree. All the steam pipes were covered with rope and painted white, and it was kept in immaculate condition always. And the pumpman with his beautiful
brass oil can
absolutely oiled every trip.
Every trip we used to oil the cogs
and the wheels, and now when you look at them and you go across all clogged up, you could nearly scrape it off with a knife.
The water supply to the steam ferries at Harwood came from our farm, and I can remember the deckhand man would ride his bike from the ferry out over the to Highfield. We grew up knowing them as the government wells. And we sort of always, as children, we would get on our little bikes and go with the puntmen out to the they were known as the government wells. They're still there. They're huge. And that was the water supply for the Harwood Ferry.
The timber were all set-size logs, and they were had a contract and were brought in, and there were always great stacks of these sizes of timber, and they'd be taken onto the ferry by wheelbarrow by the ferryman.
And Jack the Russian, I can't remember, I don't know what his name was, but Jack the Russian was one of the contractors. He was an old man that used to frighten us as children. But he used to load the his dray up with these set-size logs and take them into the wood supply of the Harwood Ferry there.
But it was they were immaculately kept, and if cattle went over, it was all hosed down and in beautiful condition. Always. Harwood was a beautifully kept set up.